day, out of the blue, and asked if she could give her friend Lewis my number, I found myself open. He saw your pictures and he keeps asking me about you, she said with a hint of irritation. Really? I was surprised. Lewis was gorgeous, tall with the athletic build of a football player and blazing features on account of his Senegalese and Vietnamese background. During the summer, I'd seen his picture on High Five, an international MySpace I used from time to time to keep up with my cousins and friends before they caught on to Facebook. My cousin Amadou, Ida's brother, was also friends with him, and so I added him, thinking nothing of it. I was pleasantly surprised then when Lewis sent me a message. Hi there. We engaged in a few two-sentence messages back and forth, but he never really asked me about myself, and so the conversation quickly died. Now, nearly 4 months later, he had emerged and asked for my number through my younger cousin. Why didn't he just ask me? I shrugged. Whatever, he was fine. Martin and I were walking around a Safeway grocery store shopping for dinner when Lewis first called me. I ignored the call because I didn't recognize the number. When I listened to his voicemail, my stomach churned with butterflies of excitement. I told Martin I was going to go look for some vegetables in another aisle and escape to listen to the message again. I called Lewis back and got his voicemail. I quickly left a message saying I was happy he'd called and that I'd try him back another time. I skipped over to Martin in the pasta aisle and we resumed shopping. The night I drove home for Christmas break, I called Lewis from a blocked number. He answered, but I hung up. What the hell was wrong with me? I couldn't ignore the memories of my previous dating disappointments. He had seen my pictures. He had already asked for my number. Why was this an issue? I practiced my sexy phone voice and then dialed with my number visible. He answered. Hello? Hi. I started with a tone that screamed phone sex operator. I shook my head and cleared my throat. I didn't have to do this. I could be myself. I continued in my normal voice. Sorry, allergies. Hi, it's great to finally meet you. As corny as it sounds, from the very first five-hour conversation Lewis and I had, I knew he was the one for me, that he would be the one I'd end up with, the one I wanted. The night before Martin went back to France, we had the worst sex ever. It was so selfish that I'm still bitter about it to this day. Maybe I deserved it. No matter what, I knew that despite the promises we'd made to try to make it work long distance, our relationship was officially over. I don't know whether or not Lewis and I will be together forever, but I know that I genuinely love him and that he has made me a better person, which is more than I've gotten out of any other relationship. With him, I've finally come to the conclusion that my parents' relationship doesn't have to inform my own. I've taken off the safety. ABG Guide, Black Women and Asian Men. Black women and Asian men are at the bottom of the dating totem pole in the United States. Yes, it's true. After many discussions and several observations over the years, I've decided that this is the case, and said as much as early as 2010. If dating were an assortment of Halloween candy, Black women and Asian men would be the Tootsie Rolls and candy corn, the last to be eaten, if even at all. If you like Tootsie Rolls and candy corn, it is a fact that you have dated or would date an Asian man or Black woman. Footnote, not based on fact. Why is this? Why will over 45% of educated Black women never get married? Why are Asian men so high in supply but so low in demand? I can offer a few explanations and guesses based on snippets of conversation, credible news outlets, and Steve Harvey. Educated Black women are too high maintenance, high strung, and independent. They don't need men. There is a widening gap between the education of Black women and men, which doesn't leave very many suitable suitors. Unfortunately, the higher one's degree as a Black woman, the lower your chances are of getting married. Add to the compile the stereotypes of being loud, complicated, and difficult. Black women, your reputation sucks. Asian men are also overburdened with racial stereotypes that don't really work in their favor. Why wouldn't women want to marry and reproduce with men who are classified as intelligent hard workers? Maybe because Asian men are frequently emasculated in the media or presented as sexless props for comedic relief. Oh, if only they could absorb the burden of black male stereotypes, genitalia exaggerations included. Maybe their demand would increase. Maybe that would make all the difference. Instead, the plight of Asian men is nearly the same as that of black women, except for the fact that their women tend to marry white or other far more often. In fact, Asian Americans have the highest rate of intermarriage. Asian men, your reputation sucks too. This is why I propose that black women and Asian men join forces in love, marriage, and procreation. Educated black women, what better intellectual match for you than an Asian man? And I'm not talking about Filipinos. They're like the blacks of Asians. I'm talking Chinese, Vietnamese, Japanese, etc. According to a 2010 census, Koreans are more inclined to marry black than any other Asian group. So black women, after college, maybe it's a good idea to settle in Los Angeles or anywhere else where Koreatown is a hotspot. Asian men, your women are ditching you at an alarming rate. Won't you consider black women? Especially you, Chinese men. There is an abundance of you, and you're not all going to get Chinese women. So why not cross over to the black side? Have you all seen how adorable Blasian babies are? Get with the program. Musical ambitions and failures. The smell of Black and Milds evokes a nostalgia for the hood rat childhood of which I was robbed. If a CD had a parental advisory explicit content label, I was forbidden from enjoying it, which meant I was excluded from the vending machine conversations in middle school. While my 13-year-old girlfriends whispered about Lil' Kim's racy hardcore album and the No Limit Soldiers music takeover, I was relegated to the role of silent listener. On rare occasions, I could at least contribute to the conversation about music videos, except for those found only on that pay-per-view video channel, The Box. Those two eluded me, as, you guessed it, the cable at my house didn't carry The Box, so I had to catch it at my grandparents' house. My affinity for my generation's music almost never was. While I have always been an R&B fiend, I used to have my nose up in the air when it came to rap music. Perhaps I was subliminally influenced by my judgmental grandfather, who associated rap music with danger and death. To his credit, he was no doubt influenced by NWA's takeover of Los Angeles. As an avid watcher of the 5, 6, and 7 o'clock news, he'd be asleep by 8 and awake by 4 a.m., I'm sure the images of gang violence in L.A. contributed to his distaste of and fear for what that music would do to his teenage grandsons. That fear rubbed off on my mother, which is part of the reason she insisted we pack up all of our bags and leave for Senegal, which we did when I was 4 years old. While the change of environment ensured that my brothers would never be in the crossfire of the notorious Bloods and Crips, it also put a huge delay on our access to American music. All I ever remember listening to in the late 80s was Michael Jackson, Senegalese music, the songs of Disney movie soundtracks, and Take My Breath Away from Top Gun, which I watched over and over again as a child. After our stint in Africa, we moved back to the States, to Maryland, and it was the likes of Boyz II Men, Jade, Jodeci, SWV, and other R&B music that dominated the blissful 90s. My mom had an issue with the overt sexuality presented in some of the song lyrics, but I was too young to understand what they meant anyway. To this day, I still have no idea what my friends in elementary school were listening to back then, as I never had conversations about music with any of them. I was one of only a few black girls in the class, and I had a naive, childish perception that black music was for black people and white music was for white people. So it never occurred to me to talk about music with my friends. My mother, on the other hand, must have been having musical conversations with my friend's parents, because I don't know where else the idea for piano lessons could have come from. My best friend in elementary school, Lisa, a Jewish girl who invited me to her family's house for my very first Passover, took piano lessons. My mother, who'd always wanted to play the piano, thought it would be a great idea to place my younger brother and me in lessons as well. Besides, my great-grandmother's old grand piano was just sitting in our living room collecting dust and random stickers, much to my mother's annoyance. Who keeps putting stickers on the piano? It was time to not only elevate her kids, but also put her piano to use. I was momentarily excited about the idea of playing the piano, if for no other reason than that my friend Lisa was doing it. My mother took us to a chic retail piano store in Montgomery Mall, because all the piano greats took lessons in suburban malls, where we were taken to the back rooms of the piano retailer to meet Mr. Forbes, a heavy, happy, spectacle-wearing man who, as I recall, looked like a young, curly-haired Philip Seymour Hoffman. He was my first real introduction to the piano, and his positive demeanor combined with a general optimism made me want to do well. He would instruct me for 30 minutes, after which I'd go next door to browse Sam Goody's music while waiting for my brother to finish his session. As our lessons with Mr. Forbes progressed, and I moved from book one to book two of instruction, I also received a raise in my allowance from $1 to $2 a week. With my newly earned disposable income, I bought my very first tape single, Brandy's I Wanna Be Down. I had owned a few tapes prior, most notably the soundtrack to Robert Townsend's Meteor Man and Raven Simone's first rap single, That's What Little Girls Are Made Of, which I later found out was produced by the brilliant Missy Elliott. Both of those tapes were picked out by me, but bought by my Tante Ray. Brandy's single marked the first time I bought music with my own money, asserting my fourth grade independence. While my mother dropped us off for an hour at the mall every week, hoping that we'd learn the classics and develop skills to give us significant advantages as young black kids, she inadvertently granted me unsupervised musical autonomy, which I relished. When Mr. Forbes moved away, much to my sadness, piano lessons were no longer exciting. Lisa's parents found another teacher, and my mom found Miss Wu, an older, hardcore, no-nonsense teacher whose highest compliment was, "Pretty good, pretty good." She got frustrated so easily. Because I worked better with positive reinforcement, my desire to please her wasn't as high, and my mother had to force us to practice more than ever. This led to multiple crying sessions at the piano. With tears and snot dripping on the keyboard, I distinctly remember yelling out, "I don't even want to do this, Mom!" And her, with unsympathetic eyes rolling infinitely, yelling back, "Do you know how many people wish they could play the piano? You will thank me when you get older." I would get confirmations from my older brothers, who'd come back to town, impressed with our piano skills, feeling robbed of their own opportunities for piano lessons as kids. This satisfaction of having something they didn't would temporarily compel me to practice. But I was more motivated by our impending move to Los Angeles, which fueled my hopes that piano lessons would be in the days of Maryland past. As luck would have it, our Los Angeles move placed us right across the street from a piano instructor. Miss Harvey literally lived 12 footsteps away from our house. Now, there were no excuses as to why we couldn't go to lessons. No convincing my mother that she was too tired to take us. Nope. As my mother could now see the house of instruction from her living room window, she actually enforced mandatory daily practice sessions, using our manual oven timer to make sure we were moving our fingers for at least 30 minutes. It was all the more painful because we practiced in the extra cold or ridiculously hot living room, also known as the good room, though the air didn't properly circulate. Piano practice interrupted television time, phone time, and even homework time. "But Mom, I'm doing homework. Do it after. It's only 30 minutes. 30 minutes felt like hours. Often, instead of sitting down and practicing my assigned song, I would listen for my mother's retreating footsteps, sneak to the kitchen, and turn the manual timer counterclockwise, deducting 10 or 15 minutes of practice time. The timer's buzz would signal a personal victory only if my mother wasn't listening. Sometimes, despite my committing to the allotted practice time, she would insist that I take more time. "I didn't hear you playing the whole time. Do 15 more minutes." Maybe I was so hesitant to invest time because part of me knew that practicing didn't matter with Miss Harvey. For one thing, Miss Harvey was in her mid-80s at best. Secondly, while she demonstrated masterful skill on the piano, she once played at Carnegie Hall, her house smelled like dried pee, and she had to tend to her 35-year-old daughter who had Down syndrome between hour-long sessions that were supposed to be 30 minutes. Finally, Miss Harvey suffered from Alzheimer's. Do you know what that means? That means that I played the same two Chopin songs for 2 years. No matter how many times I complained to my mother about this, she remained sternly amused. You're still learning. Just get really good at the songs you're learning, and now and then, slip her a new song. But Miss Harvey didn't want to play any of my songs. I slipped her the Soul Food soundtrack music book that I begged my mother to buy so that I could impress my friends with my knowledge of pop music. But nope, too secular. I slipped her People Make the World Go Round, which I knew about only because Ice Cube and the West Side Connection remade it as Gangsters Make the World Go Round. Turns out I underestimated the depth of her oldness, because even that song didn't qualify as an oldie in her book. Miss Harvey was all about the classics, which I would learn to respect later in life, but hated in my years as a middle schooler. Eventually, I resigned myself to the fact that my mother wasn't going to let up on the piano playing thing. So I tried to teach myself popular, familiarly hip tunes on the piano. If I could get the party jumping with secular tunes, then in my mind, I was guaranteed a ticket into the cool crowd. "Hey, y'all, look what Joisa can play on the piano," they'd exclaim as they all gathered around me, crip walking and grinding on the piano as I effortlessly prodded the keys and bounced to my own tunes. Piano dancing always looks cool, and it was also a way to mask what I couldn't do. Dance. Who cares that you can't dance when you can make music on the piano? That never happened. I never got good enough to play multiple songs at will. Not even when, after Miss Harvey passed, we got a new piano teacher, Mr. Reith. I was in high school and Mr. Reith was cool, energetic, fun, and gay. He never brought up his sexuality, but he didn't have to. He always talked about going to dance at the Hollywood Casino and about getting his groove on to his jams with people. He had a texturized S curl and loved playing gospel music. My gaydar wasn't too keen in high school, but Mr. Reith was my first positive ID. I would get confirmation years later. He was always excited to teach me the music I wanted to learn. With him, I finally learned Boys to Men's A Song for Mama off the Soul Food soundtrack. I learned gospel chords and melodious arpeggios, and that's about it. Because what my siblings and I loved most about Mr. Reith was how easy he was to sidetrack. That man loved to talk. Sometimes we distracted him from noticing that we hadn't practiced that week by asking him questions, the answers to which he'd drag on and on about until our time was up. My mom started to catch on and asked us if Mr. Reith's talking was getting in the way of our learning time. She didn't want to feel like she was wasting her money. Oblivious to the money she was, in fact, wasting on this man, we'd innocently and deceitfully praise his teaching methods. "He's so much better than Miss Harvey." We'd gotten so good at distracting Mr. Reith that by the time we approached our first recital, we weren't ready. At all. My mother sat back and watched as we were the only kids who flubbed and fumbled notes, pausing throughout our respective performances to figure out which keys to play. The only thing more embarrassing was that months later, Mr. Reith dropped us as clients. He regretfully informed my mother that he was adding more clients to his roster and had to focus on the ones that were taking piano seriously. Ouch. My embarrassment was short-lived because my mom finally stopped pressing us to play and came to the conclusion that forcing us wasn't going to actually make us good. Thankfully, my mother's years of piano investment wouldn't completely go to waste, as my younger brother Lamine would grow up to produce music, becoming better at the piano than I could have ever hoped to be. I always had my own musical ambitions. During the summer before 7th grade, I decided to form a rap group. I was learning how to make web pages via GeoCities and similar DIY homepage designers, and I wanted to use these pages to market my group. I mentioned to my best friend Ashley and her friend London, a beautiful, ridiculously nice 14-year-old who just moved next door to her, that we should start a rap group and that I'd make our web pages. They were initially both bored by the idea until I asserted that it would be a great way to meet guys. With a laugh and a shrug, they decided to give it a shot. I designed our website, wrote a song verse for our first single, and even came up with our official group name, Star 69. The perfect combination of star power, pop culture, and sexual innuendo. I was a genius. Unfortunately, though, my group mates weren't very serious about their rap ambitions. The internet didn't appeal to them as a viable means of hip-hop fame and fortune. And so the group faded away. By the time I left public school to enroll in Brentwood Middle School, I found my dad's stash of blank tapes. I started to record my favorite songs off the radio and discovered Oola.com, also known as the Original Hip Hop Lyrics Archive. Whereas explicit words were bleeped from the radio, I read and learned them online. I still didn't really understand what they meant, but it was a step in the right direction. When I thought I was finally on par with my peers, some of my friends in the black clique I had befriended started getting into CDs and CD players. I desperately wanted to be a part of the conversation. That year, for my Christmas wish list, I made sure to include a list of multiple CDs. I listed Mace's Harlem World, Janet Jackson's The Velvet Rope, Timbaland and Magoo's Welcome to Our World, Missy Elliott's Super Duper Fly, Boyz II Men's Evolution, and the new LSG, Lavert Sweat Gill album, because I vividly remember Keith Sweat's Nobody playing during the summer we moved to Los Angeles. His popularity could get me social points. Later, I would realize that he was popular only in a certain young mom demographic. Christmas morning, I found three CDs, the ones by Boyz II Men, Janet Jackson, and LSG. Santa Claus had apparently decided that the CDs with parental advisory labels were naughty. Though, through several listens, I found that Janet Jackson was pretty naughty. I had given up on trying to get CDs through my mother, but my birthday was coming up that January, and I decided to throw a party with some of my girlfriends. No boys allowed, my mother conditioned. How absolutely lame. Jennifer, my friend from A Better Chance, an organization for kids from diverse socioeconomic and racial backgrounds attending prep school, had just thrown her own birthday party. Her mother not only allowed boys, but set up the living room for her daughter and her friends to freak dance. That's love. I was so easily impressed by the freedom and the general semblance of a high school party that it never occurred to me that her party might be whack. I mean, who was I? Awkward, socially hungry, to deem a party uncool or lame. But that was the general sentiment when we returned to school that Monday. Jennifer's party was whack. And if her party with boys and dancing and nighttime fun was declared a failure socially, then did my party really have a chance? I should have rescinded any thoughts I had about having a party at that moment, but my mother was insistent. She thought it would be fun for me and wanted to meet all my friends. "I'll even hire a clown for you and your little friends," she offered, cracking herself up while I searched her eyes in horror. My friends arrived, prepared to be bored. All except Cherie, who remained optimistic. We sat in the living room as I tried to encourage conversation, which worked for a while, until Amber, Jennifer's best friend, who was a year older, started talking about Friday, her favorite movie of all time. I seized my opportunity to brag. "My cousins made Friday." Their eyes widened. "Ice Cube is your cousin?" "No, he made it with my cousins." "Oh, do you have it? We could watch that instead of just sitting here." This was the most excited I had seen them all night. I had to deliver, though I had never seen Friday because my mother still wouldn't let me watch R-rated movies. The living room housed a closet full of hundreds of videotapes, home movies and commercial movies alike. My friends gathered around me as I tried to find Friday. Amber grabbed the tape. "Y'all got Players Club too? Ooh." I told them my cousins had made that movie too. "Your cousins made all my favorite movies." In hindsight, that this middle schooler's favorite movies were centered around weed and strip clubs makes me sad. As they pressured me to take them to the TV room so I could immediately redeem my party, I sighed, knowing what I had to do. I went to the kitchen where my mom was slicing my party pizza into thinner slices. "Mom, they really want to watch Friday. Can we?" "Uh-uh. You know you can't. But Mom, Cousin Pat and Michael made it. Our family. Everyone wants to watch it. Please? No. Find something else to watch. Can we watch Players Club? Players Club? Absolutely not. That's even worse. But Mom, nobody's having any fun. Please, Mom. I don't want my party to suck. My mom turned to face me. Did I sense a gleam of sympathy? Find something else to watch. There are hundreds of tapes in there. I wanted to sink my head into my soft, square-shaped shell of a body and disappear. This was it. I was going to solidify my position as the loser of the group. I turned away from my mother, stiffly, ready to resign myself to that position. I broke the news and the girls looked at me, stunned. Jennifer rolled her eyes. Cherie's permanent smile wavered. Amber looked at me incredulously. So that means you haven't even seen Friday? We moved to the bedroom my little sister and I shared, where I sat on my bunk bed as I opened my gifts. Jennifer handed me hers in a small gift bag. I was excited just to receive a present from her. I threw the tissue paper to the side and looked inside. It was the Mace album. I was ecstatic, my eyes instantly darting around the room for a place to hide it from my mother. Thank you so much. I can't believe you got this for me. Jennifer shrugged. Someone gave me an extra one for my birthday, so. I didn't care that I was regifted. This was my first explicit album. I was so ready. Then Amber, who hadn't gotten me a gift, took out her own CD, Lil' Kim's hardcore album, shifting the conversation. Everybody talked about how nasty and raw the album was as she popped the CD into my boombox. I didn't have any expectations, though just looking at the album cover, with Lil' Kim in full-on squat, legs open, literally taking pictures, as my southern aunts used to say, should have been a warning. It was on this album that I heard the sound of a vagina being eaten. Something I didn't know up until that point could be done. I turned it off quickly, horrified that my mother would walk in, and the girls were at last understanding. Then the conversation shifted to talking about our own personal sexual experiences, and or lack thereof. I decided I was too young to hear that album in its entirety. I was kind of offended and embarrassed that Lil' Kim was so explicit. Maybe my mother was right to shield me from that kind of music. But that didn't mean I was going to throw out my May CD. Owning the CD finally allowed me to contribute to the conversations I'd been missing out on around the proverbial water cooler, i.e. the vending machine. It broadened my social life, opened a door that I didn't want to close. I was so desperate not to close it that weeks later, I constructed a web of lies about my music collection that later came to bite me in the ass. Courtney, Allison's older sister, and the leader of our lunchtime group, a group comprised of the only black kids in school, minus a few ambitious blacks, proposed throwing a lunchtime party in our designated spot under the shady tree of the school's roundabout. She had already begun a trend of pooling our money once a month and ordering Domino's pizza. If you didn't bring your money, you didn't get pizza. So she suggested having a mini party with pizza and music. We were talking about the music we were feeling. Drew Hill's Enter the Drew, Puff Daddy's No Way Out, Missy's Super Duper Fly, and the Timbaland and Magoo, Aaliyah and Genuine squad that accompanied her. And something possessed me to claim that I owned all of those albums. She turned to me. For real? All of them? Well, some of them are my older brothers, but basically. Courtney and Allison exchanged glances. Then Courtney asked, can you bring them? If you bring them on Friday, I can have a mix made over the weekend and bring it to the lunch party. My heart dropped. Yeah, for sure. Courtney grew excited. This party is about to be so tight. They resumed talking about whatever as my head swirled, thinking about how I'd obtained access to one of these CDs, much less all of them. My allowance had increased to $5 a week, but I had poor spending habits and no inclination to save for potential self-imposed emergencies. Why was the ownership of the music that people cherished so important to me? Why did I feel the need to fabricate an elaborate collection? Did I want people to like me that badly? Had I the tech prowess necessary then, I surely would have been the first to create Napster, which burst on the scene just a year later. I went to school the following day, the day before my Friday deadline, hoping Courtney had forgotten about my claims. No such luck. When lunchtime came around, she greeted me excitedly. You're bringing the CDs tomorrow, right? Yeah, I meant to bring them today, but tomorrow for sure. Cool. Jennifer and Cherie, y'all bringing yours too, right? Yep, exclaimed Cherie and Jennifer simultaneously between chews. Great, we're set. Don't forget the money for the pizza too. Who the hell raised her to be so damn responsible? That responsibility would eventually lead her successfully into and through med school, but who's keeping track? I wanted time to stand still. I wanted a major distraction to make everyone forget my promise, but I had no luck. I sat at home trying to figure out what I could do to soften the blow of not making good on a promise. Then it hit me. I stayed my ass home from school. I convinced my mother that I was sick. It was the perfect plan. Missing school on a Friday would give me the entire weekend for them to forget about my non-delivery. Sure, the party was the coming Monday, but at least I wouldn't have to fess up to my lie. The mix CD would already be made, the pizza would already be ordered, and my reputation would be blemished, but not tarnished. As predicted, that Monday, I was passive-aggressively ostracized as I tried to play up how bad my sudden weekend sickness was. More than ever, I needed to find a way to redeem myself, musically. One day, I was perusing a Vibe magazine issue, back when Mimi Valdez, whom I would later work with, was the editor-in-chief, and I came across the Columbia House BMG ads that were generously inserted throughout music magazines. The advertisement stated that you could get 12 CDs for the price of 1 cent. This was absolutely within my price range, so it must have been too good to be true. I gave it a shot anyway, perusing their catalog, picking out CDs that I wanted or had heard my friends discussing. I didn't get any parental advisory CDs for fear of my mother discovering and opening the package before me. I was only 13, so I didn't have a credit card or a checkbook, but luckily they had a bill me later option. I was tempted to include a penny in the envelope, but didn't want to chance it falling out. The day the package arrived, I was home. I opened it and saw the holy grail of 90s music in front of me. 112's Room 112, Brandy's Never Say Never, Drew Hill's Enter the Drew, Lauryn Hill's The Miseducation of Lauryn Hill, Monica's The Boy Is Mine, and Maya's self-titled debut album. 6 CDs were more than I had ever owned at once. Apparently they gave you 6 CDs to start and expected payment before they sent the other 6. The bill was definitely more than a penny, so I had no intentions of paying it. I can proudly say that I had my first and only black mark on my credit when I was 13 years old. Thanks for teaching me the value of a penny, BMG. When I turned 16, 1 year shy of the parental advisory age restriction, my mother was kind enough to allow me to finally see R-rated movies. Since I was driving by that time, she probably figured that I was going to see them anyway. She was right. I don't know why I didn't break the rule sooner. Maybe I was content with being shielded from certain adult themes. After all, I do remember being a high school junior and wanting to wait until marriage to lose my virginity. I laugh at that notion now. Innocence after elementary school is so contrived. When I got to high school, sex took on another dimension. One beyond what I could glimpse in explicit lyrics and videos. High school was also where I was exposed to the hood in all its glory. I was a fascinated outsider, simultaneously wanting to belong, but to not be included. Everybody wants to be hood, but nobody really wants to be hood. In the post-Luke era, high school is also where music started to get exceptionally raunchy. I remember such gems as, I Just Wanna Fuck You, and Ludacris' debut single, What's Your Fantasy, where, during a lunch dance, a bunch of 14-year-old students happily yelled out the bridge while popping their pelvises and asses. I wanna get you in the back seat, windows up, that's the way you like to fuck. High school is also where I gave my music ambitions another shot. My sophomore year, I got Mr. E for chemistry. He was Persian, had med school ambitions, and lots of money, but wanted to give back via Teach for America, and was one of the coolest teachers ever. We were the envy of the high school when he decided to take all his chemistry classes to Magic Mountain that year, for no reason. It was in Mr. E's second period class that I grew close to many of my current friends, but most importantly, where I formed HACTA. The group was comprised of three of the prettiest girls from my high school, two of whom became models, one of whom was a top three finalist on America's Top Model, and me. Daisy, who took it absolutely seriously, is one of my current friends. She was born and raised in Compton, was super smart, ranked number 11 in our class at graduation, was a talented dancer, never stressed about guys because she didn't have to and they sweated her, and like me, she loved the music of the Hood Rats. The day we formed HACTA, which was an acronym of our last names, she wrote the verses to two songs that night. While HACTA never amounted to much, Daisy's dedication to the art form of ratchetry would always stick with me, even when we went away to different colleges. Despite going to school in Compton, the breeding ground of gangster rap, and the source of inspiration for many rappers, it wasn't until I attended Stanford that my ratchet aspirations were truly nurtured. In the middle of Palo Alto, I met three girls who enabled me. One night, over a series of drunken freestyle sessions my senior year of college, we formed JAMMED, an acronym of our first names. I wasn't very creative with titles. I got the idea to record our session on my computer and then created a picture collage on Windows Media Maker of our first freestyle single, Fuck You Bitch. It was my very first YouTube video and my very first music hit. The YouTube video would go on to amass over 150,000 views. Our peers loved the song and loved the video. We'd go on to create three more singles, Nani Pop, a dance dedicated to female pelvic thrusts, Caterkiller, an angry gangsta anthem about murdering the caterpillars that infested our campus, and Working the V, a song about vaginal attention, promptly made private after my eldest brother commented on the video. After I graduated and moved to New York, my musical ambitions took a hiatus due to a lack of enablers. All of my friends were too busy taking their careers seriously, while I was still trying to figure myself out. But my desire never went away. In fact, the discovery that my younger brother's music group, Fly Guys, had gained a bit of internet fame due to a popular dance group using their song in a video actually helped to restore my hope for a musical future. When I moved back to Los Angeles after a 2-year stint in New York, making a music video for Fly Guys was one of my first projects. Between their lyrics, their stage presence, and their dedication, I learned a lot from them. In Los Angeles, I was also reunited with my best friends from high school. In the summer of 2009, before I returned to Senegal, Jerome, Devin, and Daisy, my fellow HACTA alum, were joking around in our Facebook messages and decided to throw a party at my mother's house and invite all our mutual friends. It was my LA homecoming party, and it was also the formation of the Doublemint Twins, now known as the Doublemints. That same summer, a group trip to Magic Mountain and an accompanying heat wave prompted us to start singing, "That's why we got on our booty shouts, booty shouts." So pleased with ourselves, we vowed we would make that our first single. Around the same time, the first episode of Awkward Black Girl was still stewing in my head. By the time I figured out what the opening scene was going to be, I knew I wanted to include a raunchy song. While I initially envisioned a Nicki Minaj song, when we sat down and actually recorded our lyrics on my computer, I was inspired to make it the opening song of my first episode. A week before I premiered the first episode, we recorded the single in the Fly Guys Garage Bay studio, and boom, magic was made. Even with my love for ratchet music, I've always had a fear of what my children will be listening to in the future, when they are in middle school. I have a preemptive desire to shield them from sex for as long as possible and to protect their innocence as my parents did for me. I joke with a college friend of mine, Adia, who had the same parental restrictions as I did, that we will raise our kids around one another. We agree that friends make all the difference in the exposure you have and the life choices you make. I don't regret meeting any of my friends, and I don't regret my generation's affinity for ratchet music. And while my high school and college reunions will contain the raunchiest soundtracks, I won't ever bring that shit home to my future kids. The struggle. I don't remember the exact day I demilitarized for my blackness. It's all a blur, and since I'm fairly certain that militants never forget, and I forget stuff all the time, I guess I wasn't meant to be one. I love being black. That's not a problem. The problem is that I don't want to always talk about it, because honestly, talking about being black is extremely tiring. I don't know how Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson do it. I know why Cornel West and Tavis Smiley do it. They love the attention and the groupies. But the rest of these people who talk, think, and breathe race every single day, how? Just how? Aren't they exhausted? The pressure to contribute to these conversations now that we have a black president is even more infuriating. What do you think about what's going on in the world and how our black president is handling it? Asked a race baiter. It's all good, I guess. I want to answer apathetically with a Kanye shrug, I'm over it. But am I really? Could I be even if I wanted to? Even now I feel obligated to talk about race. It's as though it's expected of me to acknowledge what we all already know. The truth is, I slip in and out of my black consciousness, as if I'm in a racial coma. Sometimes I'm so deep in my anger, my irritation, my need to stir change, that I can't see anything outside of the lens of race. At other times, I feel guilty about my apathy. But then I think, isn't this what those who came before me fought for? The right not to have to deal with race? If faced with a choice between fighting until the death for freedom and civil rights and living life without any acknowledgement of race, they choose the latter. Growing up as a young black girl in Potomac, Maryland was easy. I never really had to put much thought into my race, and neither did anybody else. I had a rainbow coalition of friends of all ethnicities, and we would carelessly skip around our elementary school like the powerless version of Captain Planet's Planeteers. I knew I was black. I knew there was a history that accompanied my skin color, and my parents taught me to be proud of it. End of story. All that changed when my family moved to Los Angeles and placed me in a middle school where my blackness was constantly questioned. And not even necessarily in the traditional sense, i.e., you talk white Oreo girl, or you can't dance white girl. Those claims were arguable for the most part. My biggest frustration and the challenge to prove my blackness usually stemmed from two very annoying, very repetitive situations. Situation number one. I'm not even black, and I'm blacker than you. It's one thing when other African Americans try to call me out on my race card, but when people outside my ethnicity have the audacity to question how down I am because of the bleak, stereotypical picture pop culture has painted of black women, it's a whole other thing. Unacceptable. I can recall a time when I was having a heated discussion with a white male classmate of mine. Our eighth grade class was on a museum field trip as the bus driver blasted Puff Daddy's Been Around the World to drown us out. It began as a passive competition of lyrics, as we each silently listened for who would mess up first. By the second verse, our lazy rap whispers escalated to an aggressive volume, accompanied by rigorous side eyes by the time we got to, "Playa, please, I'm the macaroni with the cheese." And I felt threatened. Was this fool seriously trying to out-rap me? And why did I care? After the song ended, he offered his opinion. Puff Daddy is whack, yo. How dare he? Not only was I pissed, but I felt as if he had insulted my own father. Who did I think I was, Puff Daughter? Puff Daddy is tight, I retorted. He rolled his eyes and said, "Have you heard of, insert underground rapper? Now he's dope." I hadn't heard of him, but I couldn't let this white boy defeat me in rap music knowledge, especially as others started to listen. "Yeah, I know him. He's not dope," I lied for the sake of saving face. Perhaps because he saw through me or because he actually felt strongly about this particular artist, he asked me to name which songs I thought were not dope. Panic set in as I found myself exposed. Then, you don't even know him, huh? Have you even heard of, insert other random underground rapper? As he continued to rattle off the names of make-believe-sounding MCs, delighted that he had one-upped me, he managed to make me feel as though my credibility as a black person relied on my knowledge of hip-hop culture. My identity had been reduced to the bad boy label clique, as this boy seemingly claimed my black card as his own. Of course, as I grew older and Mace found his calling as a reverend, I realized there was more to being black than a knowledge of rap music, and that I didn't have to live up to this pop cultural archetype. I began to take pride in the fact that I couldn't be reduced to a stereotype, and that I didn't have to be. This leads me to my next situation. Situation number two. Black people don't do that. Or so I'm told by a black person. These two are derived from mostly negative stereotypes shaped by popular culture. The difference is that in these situations, we black people are the ones buying into these stereotypes. When I was a teenager, for example, others questioned my blackness because some of the life choices I made weren't considered to be black choices. Joining the swim team when it's a known fact that black people don't swim. Or choosing to become a vegetarian when blacks clearly love chicken. These choices and the various positive and negative responses to them helped to broaden my own perspective on blackness and eventually caused me to spurn these self-imposed limitations. But not before embarrassing the hell out of myself in a poor attempt to prove I was down. I'll never forget submitting a school project in Ebonics for my 7th grade English class just to prove that I could talk and write black. I was trying to prove it to myself just as much as I was to everyone around me. Even in my early adulthood, post-college, I'd overtip to demonstrate I was one of the good ones. Only recently have I come to ask, what am I trying to prove and to whom am I proving it? Today, I haven't even completely rid myself of the feeling that I'm still working through Du Bois' double consciousness. For the majority of my life, I cared too much about how my blackness was perceived. But now, at this very moment, I couldn't care less. Call it maturation or denial or self-hatred, I give no fucks. And it feels great. I've decided to focus only on the positivity of being black, and especially of being a black woman. Am I supposed to feel oppressed? Because I don't. Is racism supposed to hurt me? That's so 1950s. Should I feel marginalized? I prefer to think of myself as belonging to an exclusive club. While experiencing both types of situations, being made to feel not black by down white people on one hand and not black enough by the blacks in the so-called no on the other, has played a role in shaping a more comfortably black me, in the end, I have to ask, who's to say what we do and don't do? What we can and can't do? The very definition of blackness is as broad as that of whiteness, yet the media seemingly always tries to find a specific, limited definition. As CNN produces news specials about us and white and Latino rappers feel culturally dignified in using the N-word, our collective grasp of blackness is becoming more and more elusive. And that may not be a bad thing. African. Growing up post coming to America had some benefits. For one, the 1988 film helped to counter the stereotypical impoverished National Geographic images of Africa that so many were used to seeing at that time. Ironically, the year prior, Eddie Murphy's own comedy special, Raw, had helped to perpetuate the notion of uncivilized Africans. Mfufu, with the bone in her nose, formerly butt naked on a zebra, suddenly expressed her dissatisfaction with the economic inequality of their relationship. Eddie, why you treat me like animal? Coming to America brought on a shift in dumb questions from, oh, you're from Africa? Do you hunt lions? To, oh, you're from Africa? Is your family royalty? I didn't have any African friends outside of family until I went to high school. Even then, the many Nigerians there didn't flaunt their African ancestry. And I wasn't included in their clique because I wasn't one of them. In my French class, I met a girl named Monique from Zaire who, like me, already spoke French and was taking the class to get an easy A. More advanced in her French than I was, she knew all the French slang and spoke in the tone of a peppy valley girl. She seemed to relish the opportunity to secretly talk shit about our peers in French. Le gars là est trop con, she'd exclaimed to me with a smile and a sweet tone that suggested we were discussing flowers and candy. And we became fast friends when she found out I was from Senegal. Oh my God, the guys in Senegal are so cute. The first time I ever felt beautiful was when I went back to Senegal my sophomore year of high school. It was the first time I had boys and men pining after me. As a moderate feminist, I shouldn't rely on the validation of men to feel a sense of worth. But as I mentioned, it was high school, so stop judging. Initially, I convinced myself that all of this sudden attention was because I had lived in America. I wasn't naive to the fact that many Senegalese men saw foreign women as an opportunity to escape, to establish a better life abroad. Americans were particularly coveted, back when the dollar meant a damn. Before euros emerged as the desired currency, everyone wanted to go to the States. Even people who swore they hated America wanted a piece of it, somehow, someway. I took this into account whenever I was hit on, or whenever I was proposed to, or whenever men offered to impregnate me. You know, the usual. European and American women of all shapes, sizes, and facial structures were shamelessly courted by Senegalese men of varying beauty, so I knew not to take their attention too seriously. In some sense, we were all like the hefty, juicy chicken mirages seen only by the hungry, thirsty stragglers lost in the desert, fantasizing about survival. But whatevs, I finally experienced what it meant to feel beautiful. And part of me denied that I was in the same category as those other women, because I was part Senegalese. I was a product of their generational loins, indirectly. Superficial reasons aside, my other feelings of beauty stemmed from the interactions I had with my Senegalese family, whom I hadn't seen since elementary school. I was on the brink of womanhood now, and I had a new appreciation for them. One particular cousin, De Awa, is someone I've looked up to since childhood. With smooth ebony skin and sculpted features, she is absolutely beautiful. The running joke among the family is that she's too skinny, but there was always a general consensus that she could come to the States and be a model easily. She and her older sister, Lisa, who was closer in age to my older brother, were the absolute coolest. Lisa was what the Senegalese call Claire. Literally clear, meaning light skin, which by Senegalese standards meant her skin was copper-colored. Curvy and very beautiful, she could have had her pick of men. To know that I was related to these two alone already instilled in me a sense of pride. But when I returned the summer before my 10th grade year and was reunited with all of my aunts, my first cousins, and some of my first cousins' children under the roof of the family patriarch, I was overwhelmed with happiness. This was my family. We had actually moved to Senegal as a family when I was 3 years old. My dad felt we needed to learn more discipline, and my mother was worried about what the budding Los Angeles gang violence would mean for her three sons, then aged 12, 10, and a few months. As a toddler, I had no qualms about the move, but for my older brothers, it was the end of the world. Amadou and Malik had friends and reputations they were leaving behind in the only city they knew. They were devastated, which is probably why their love affair with Senegal is, to this day, a bit tenuous. I had no idea about anything life had to offer, so the adaptation was fairly easy for me. Senegalese food? Bring it on. Wolof and French? Guess I'm trilingual up in here. Yes, my parents were ready to start a new life in Senegal, leaving the States behind for good. During the time we spent there, we had a great life. We lived in a huge, multi-level house with a security guard and two maids in an affluent area called Anmarist. I could see my cousins whenever I wanted to and was in a school where my Americanness made me special. Life was great for 2 years, until my father attempted to build a hospital in Senegal and instead got ripped off by the government, losing most of his money in the process. That's when, to my sadness and my older brother's relief, we packed our bags to return to the States. We wouldn't come back to visit until I was 10 years old. And while that visit served as a brief reminder of what once was, it didn't trigger any fond nostalgia. In fact, during that particular visit, the one thing I took back with me was Rochelle, a cruel nickname given to me by my mother on the plane ride back home. One of my only surface gripes with Senegal, due to the several horrible experiences and really the general grossness of them, is the abundance of cockroaches. If you don't see them, they're somewhere. The incident that sparked my new nickname began at the Dakar airport on our way back home to Potomac, Maryland. I really had to use the restroom and couldn't wait until we got past the ticketing line to go. I was wearing an all-white boo-boo with beautiful color-printed accents and these cute white harem pants. The outfit was a parting gift from a relative that my mother insisted, to demonstrate our appreciation, I put on right away. My family waited for me in the ticketing area as I pee-pee danced to the bathroom. As soon as I walked inside, I knew I didn't want to be in there for very long. It smelled like a urine fairy was floating around the bathroom, blowing his pee-pee breath ever so delicately directly up my nostrils. I rushed inside the stall and pulled down my pants, only to look down and see several small roaches scurrying along the floor tiles. I quickly pulled my pants up to my thighs, holding them tightly while keeping balance enough to squat over the seatless toilet, all the while attempting to keep my eye on every single roach to ensure my safety. When I got out of the restroom, before I could tell my mother about the nastiness, she rushed us to the gate. In the middle of the 13-hour plane ride back home, I kept feeling a strange brushing sensation on my inner thigh. Being a stupid child, apparently too lazy to investigate unfamiliar sensations, I ignored the tingling the first 3 times it occurred. Maybe the cloth in my new pants was especially stringy in the crotch area. After the 4th brush-up, I reached down and discovered a hole right in the center of my pants. Intrigued, I stuck my hand near my inner thigh to see what was causing my irritation. I grabbed what I thought was a loose piece of fabric or a tag, held it to my face for closer inspection, and was met with the absolutely disgusting cycling legs of a thick, 3-inch-long cockroach. I freaked the entire hell out and instinctively threw it out of my hands next to me, where my younger brother sat. Horrified, he let out a high-pitched squeal and brushed it off his chest and sent it flying down to the aisle between him and my mother, where it landed on its pedaling feet. My mother, who sat holding a 4-year-old Elise, looked at the walking roach and shrieked with alarm. As it made its way to the front of the plane, my mother tapped the man sitting in front of her, who was engaged in reading a newspaper, and asked him with pleading, panicked politeness, "Monsieur, could you please kill that roach?" In response, the man barely turned his eyes to the floor where the roach leisurely roamed and calmly told her, "No." He resumed his newspaper reading as the roach prepared for his new life in New York. And that's the story of how Rochelle was almost impregnated by a cockroach. In general, my mother and father have always been very good about keeping some aspect of Senegal in our lives, whether they intended to or not. One incident particularly endeared me to that culture. Alioun was one of my Aunt Mambinta's friends and one of the many Senegalese visitors over the years who had extended his stay in our home. My mother quickly learned that when she said "I do" to my father, she said "I do" to his culture, which states that any visitor is welcome to stay at your house, eat your food, and cause you inconvenience indefinitely, family or not. Many relatives took advantage of my dad's generosity and general politeness. In addition to sponsoring the visits of over 50 relatives and close family friends, my father has repeatedly housed at least half of them. Alioun had been in our Los Angeles home for only a couple of days when, during a balcony smoke break, he saw what appeared to be a black baby doll floating on top of our backyard pool. Upon closer inspection, he realized it was my unconscious body and promptly ran down to jump in the pool and retrieve me. At only 1.5 years old, I had wandered outside alone and fallen into the gateless pool. My mother called the paramedics in a frenzy as my brothers rushed outside to watch while Alioun administered CPR to me. Had it not been for a random Senegalese stranger staying at our house, I would certainly be dead. This is a fact I'm sure my mother never forgot, and that